I like how you segued into this topic of mathematization. Tell us more.
I think that we should first see what Christianos and the others is trying to do. Christianos is trying to provide a description of the alchemical art, and above all, but this is crucial for him, to interpret ancient masters, ancient authorities on key topics of Greek alchemy. One of these topics is the notion of the divine water. Divine water is a solution that can turn the surface color of a metal into another color. Can make a silver object appear as a golden one. And I myself, along with other people like Lawrence Principe and Matteo Martelli, we have achieved this. We have worked on this. The most famous recipe contained in the Leyden X papyrus, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, is number 87. It's about the making of divine water. And, you know, as long as you understand it, it is not easy to understand it at first, to grasp its meaning, but then it is, you know, pretty easy. You're taking strong vinegar or the urine of a youth.
Okay.
It has to be of a youth because of the pH.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Then you put in this urine or strong vinegar in a pot, and you add sulfur and an equal amount of lime, and you put it upon heat. It starts to boil. You have to gently heat it, but once it is ready, and it is very funny because the papyrus says that it is ready when it has become red as blood. And then you're taking it off and you have to apply it neat, you know, clean. Mm-hmm. And by immersing, by baptizing a piece of silver into this, and after, of course, many trials and errors, you get, after many trials and errors, to have a former silver object that now appears to have a gold luster. You know, it is actually a patination.
Mm, yeah.
A patina that has come up on the surface. And of course, it has nothing to do with magic. It's calcium polysulfides that do the job. So, there are several ways of making this divine water. And, you know, the main ingredients are, as I said, sulfur and or lime. And there was a big discussion about how to understand what is divine water. So, Christianos wants to interpret these key topics, like what a divine water is. But on the other hand, and this is complementary, he wants to interpret the obscurity and vagueness of the alchemical language of the ancient authorities. Because, as you well know, they are notoriously perplexing. Mm. Lot of code names, lot of symbolism, a lot of, you know, variations, and all this kind of stuff. So, his great goal is to show that the alchemical literature is not as perplexing as it seems at the first glance. He wants to develop an alchemical method. And this alchemical method is mathematical. In one of his works called 30 Chapters on Making Gold, okay, he's taking the issue of the egg. I mean, an actual egg.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, the egg was had a lot of symbolic meaning.
Yeah.
Since the ancient world. It represented the soul, the cosmos.
The Orphic egg of
course, Diogenes, of course, yeah. Thank you. But Christianos says that we know that the matter is quadripartite.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because we have the four elements. And so these four elements correspond to the four parts of an egg. The cell, the membrane, the white, and the yolk.
Hmm.
Okay. So, Christianos is not the first that he's talking about the distillation of eggs, because this is what he's going to talk about. We have some other recipes that talk also about the treatment of eggs. The thing is that Christianos wants to show that if you do things in a certain way and following a certain methodology, then there is no way that you're not going to have an outcome.
Right. So this is a hard science after all.
Yes, it is. Hmm. It is. So Christianos says that that the actual egg can be treated in three ways: with fire, without fire, or with a mixed method.
Okay. I thought you were going to say poached, scrambled, or fried, but anyway, yes, go on.
No. So, but the other thing is that you do not have to use the entire egg, the whole four parts of the egg.
Right.
You can treat either one part of the egg, either three parts of the egg, either, you know, one part of the egg, or all four parts of the egg. And in this, he follows Plato. These are his own words.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so he says that when we're using four parts of the egg, we have one combination. And this combination is, of course, that we use the cell and the membrane and the white and the yolk. We can process these four parts of the egg with three possible methods. As I said, with fire, without fire, or with a mixed way. And these compounds can be in three states. And the state is dry, liquid, or being in a middle state. So from these, he says that we have one combination multiplied by three methods of processing, multiplied by three states of the compounds, and hence we have nine generic classes. And he goes to do that for every other given combination. I mean, with three parts of the egg, we have four combinations. You know, we have cell, membrane, white, or cell, or membrane and yolk, and so on and so forth, multiplied by three methods of processing, multiplied by three, again, states of the compounds. We have 36 generic classes. Then we have two parts of the egg, and so on and so forth, which produce 54 generic classes. And then we have one part of the egg. This means just one of the four components, cell or membrane or white or yolk. By three methods, by three states, 36 generic classes. And then he adds these generic classes, 9 plus 36 plus 54 plus 36 again, and he says that the entirety of the classes of alchemical production amounts to 135. Nothing can go beyond that. And in this sense, by using what nowadays we call combinatorics in mathematics, in this sense, he has made finite the alchemical opus. Beyond these 135 ways of doing things, he says there is nothing.
Wow, yeah. Making it finite is very interesting. The notion that you might be able to possible outcomes of a science like this mathematically is going to end up becoming a very powerful notion. The periodic table of the elements or something like that, and say that this is the outcome of that approach eventually, you know. So it's a very powerful move and interesting. And this is sort of first showing up in Christianos.
Yeah. Wow. This is the first time that we have it. And, you know, it is very interesting that after him, the... the anonymous philosopher, his name is Greek, is Anepigraphos, without a name. Follows him, of course, he appears later than him, but the anonymous philosopher himself takes for granted, he explicitly refers to it, that we have only 135 ways of doing things. So, by the anonymous philosopher's time, this was more or less something that had become concrete.
Standard, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, standard. And then anonymous philosopher tries to do the same with music. I mean, if Christianos uses as an example, as a basis, not as an example, arithmetic, and then he also uses geometry, I'm not going to expand on this because it is more difficult, then another mathematical science is music, and Christianos tries to show, by using an analogy, that as the egg has four parts, so does music, which also has four elements as its constituents. He calls them γενικότατη στοχή, γενικότατοι στοχοί.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. The essential, or the elements that give rise to it as an art.
Yeah. Of course, this is based on the Byzantine theory of music, but you know, he more or less does the same thing, that these γενικότατη στοχή correspond to the four elements of the world. And we can say that the conclusion is that if you do not follow this methodology, which uses music as an analogy for alchemy, then you are going to create cacophony, Anonymous right. says. So I think that what matters for them is not only to provide a concrete methodological, you know, way of doing things, but also to demarcate the field of alchemy as a field that should be accessed only to philosophers and not to charlatans.
Right.
Because, you know, this cacophony thing implies people that are just putting things in a pot, like amateurs or something like that. So, mathematics both elevate, in my opinion, alchemy closer to the four mathematical sciences, and in this sense, it further legitimizes it. But at the same time, mathematization, because, you know, it is something very demanding, in a sense excludes those who are not, between, you know, quotations, philosophers.
Which is, from the perspective of the philosophers, would be no bad thing. And we know that in Egypt, in the Egyptian context, there had been a lot of protections around the knowledge of alchemical practices evolving out of the old temple, I don't even know what to call them, like temple sort of monopoly, temple mini-economy setups. People might want to listen to our interview with Martin Stadler in the Roots of Magic section about the temple at Edfu, where he talks about how these temples had their own kind of, they were little mini states. They had the economies and specialist craftsmen and all that stuff. So having evolved out of that, say, guild secrecy, guild protecting the guild secrets tradition in Egypt, it would make sense actually that alchemy, if transported to a new setting, which doesn't have those guilds, doesn't have any of that stuff, would need to find new ways to police its boundaries, right?
Yeah, I agree. But on the other hand, you know, we have this shift in Christianos' writings. Christianos is doing something very important among his chapters. He includes also an alchemical oath, which is very much like, you know, the Hippocratic Oath.
Right.
Yeah, but it's an oath that has to do with proper conduct, of course. with God-pleasing morals, let's say. But the important thing is that he explicitly says that he did not hide anything. He fully disclosed everything. And in my opinion, this again shows the dependency of alchemy to divine knowledge. He does not have any more to hide things as an alchemical philosopher. Because if divine grace does not visit an alchemist that has a proper contact, he will not going to understand what the writings of the ancient philosophers say.
Mm.
So, you know, in my opinion, this is also a very important development.
For sure. The move from the secret to the self-hiding secret. It's in plain sight and everyone can see it, but you can only see it if you can see it.
Now you're saying like this, it reminds me of Edgar Allan Poe's, you know, the hiding in plain sight.
The purloined letter. Yeah.
It reminds me,
to be honest, of the whole, it's not the same thing, but what it reminds me of is in late antiquity, especially, we see a rise in thought from the Hermetica to some certain Gnostic texts, to indeed some Christian texts, where, and you can already see this in Philo of Alexandria, for example, where the notion of the aretos, that which cannot be spoken, is taken from the realm of it can't be spoken because we are enforcing cultic secrecy, into the realm of it can't be spoken because it's by its nature in what we would call ineffable, right? The rise of the idea of the ineffable as the locus of the esoteric. Who protects the esoteric? Well, if the esoteric just can't be said, it's ineffable, then it protects itself. And it's up to the seeker to somehow make themselves worthy of the knowledge. So in this case, living the right alchemical life, whatever exactly that entails, then the esoteric will reveal itself to you when you read the ancient texts. And you'll go, aha, and you'll have a breakthrough in the laboratory because you got it. So that it reminds me of that, this notion of the self-revealing, self-hiding core of esotericism, which is really one of the most powerful discursive dynamics of esotericism as a whole, I think, you know.
No, you're right. This is very interesting.
Now, you mentioned the bad alchemists, the ones who don't practice the right way. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about charlatans and con artists and stuff like that, because I know this is something you've written on in the East Roman context. Maybe if we get a picture of what the wrong kind of alchemist is, we can get a better idea of what the right kind of alchemist is, you know? Because later on, like when Ben Jonson wrote his play, The Alchemist, the name alchemist is almost synonymous with charlatan. It's what it means. It means someone who convinces you that they have amazing powers, gets all your money, and then your money's gone.
No, I think that this is a fascinating side of alchemy in Byzantium. You know, the thing is, as you well know, that alchemy has this affinity with artisanal practices, you know, with arts in general. I mean, not only with other sciences like, you know, medicine or pharmacology or something like this, and of course, natural philosophy, but it is both a theory and a practice. So, concerning practice, we have this affinity with goldsmiths, of course, with mint workers, with dyers, and all these kind of professions. We know that people were appearing now and then, and they were claiming that they're able to change, let's say, base metals into gold or silver. But the most paradigmatic story is the one that considers Ioannis Isthmaeus, John Malalas in the 6th century wrote about him. And this is a very important story because this this character, this Isthmeos, appeared in Antioch during during the reign of Anastasius I, late 5th, early 6th century. It is important that this Isthmeos, he secretly appeared in the workshops of the goldsmiths and showed them some figurines made of gold. And he claimed that he had found a hole that was containing them. And he coined a lot, and after that he escaped to Constantinople, where he also tried to con many goldsmiths until the emperor, of course, became aware of him and banished him to Petra, where he died. Well, the thing is that this is the first time in a non-alchemical text that we have the appellation Himeftis, which means alchemist.
Ah, yeah, right.
No, to be more accurate, it does not mean alchemist. It approaches what we mean by the term alchemist, because it is a whole discussion and debate what these names really mean.
Yeah, maybe like chymist in English, with a spelt with a Y, like the old-fashioned
spelling
of chemist.
Yeah,
right.
So, in any case, he's called Himeftis. This is the first time that the term appears in non-alchemical literature, and this is one of the first times that the term appears in Byzantine literature, including alchemical literature as a whole. And it is very important that he's called both Himeftis and Impostor, Epithetis.
Mm.
So, in this narrative, the practical aspect of alchemy, the making of things appearing as golden ones or something like this, goes in tandem with the term impostor. And you know, this is very important. Mm. On the other hand, and this raises the question, who were the proper alchemists?
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
Who is doing these things? Who a proper alchemist is, I mean, socially and, you know, in terms of environment and context and status and all these things? Well, I think, and I'm going to show you something like that in the next minutes, talking about Michael Psellos.
Yeah.
That
friend of the podcast, Michael Psellos.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
He's definitely a gentleman who's already showing up in the podcast as we look forward, just because so many esoteric currents from antiquity reemerge in his period.
I know what you mean. Well, it would not be so far-fetched to think that some of the technicians, some of the artisans, some of the, you know, this kind of people were actually in the service, were hired in order to complete the alchemical opus technically. I mean, that maybe they had a supervisor that had the theoretical knowledge, but, you know, it is not easy to have both the theoretical knowledge and the practical knowledge and to be able to put these things in practice. And perhaps people were hiring, artisans in order to achieve the technical outcome of the alchemical opus. But of course,
yeah.
But of course, this is only speculation on the one hand, and it does not mean that for every single recipe, because some of them are relatively simple, you would need an experienced artisan. I mean, the expertise of an artisan.
That's an interesting speculation, though,
yeah.
That you'd be bringing in technicians. I mean, much as the philosopher of the 17th century brought in the Robert Hooks of the world to realize their highfalutin ideas for experiments. Like, how could we do this experiment? He's like, I can build it for you, right?
Yes. But there were other kinds of amateurs, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael Psellos refers to that by implication. Michael Psellos is perhaps the most famous Byzantine philosopher, as you well know, and among his magnificent and vast opus, he also wrote a letter treatise on how to make gold, which was dedicated to the patriarch Michael I Kerularius. Psellos, not in this treatise, usually justifies his polymathy because, as you know, and as you will hear in these next podcasts that you refer to, he was an omnifarious philosopher, and he says that the philosopher owes to be omnifarious. So it is not, a great surprise that he deals also with alchemy among his many interests. The thing is that in this letter treatise, which is very important, Psellos conceives alchemy as rational. And this is very important because he says it has nothing to do with ineffable rites, with spell casting, with all these, kinds of things.
And he knows whereof he speaks.
He's
also written on theurgy and stuff like that. So he knows all about ineffable rites and spell casting.
This is a good point. And, he says that anything happens by means of natural alteration. And it is very important to say that he even introduces a term for transmutation or for the alchemical opus in general. He calls it techni tis metavolis, the art of change. So for him, everything happens by natural means, not spells. And this is important because it implies that for some people who were either hostile to alchemy or not enough knowledgeable of it, alchemy must have seemed like something like magic. I mean, it's transmutational aspects.
Yeah.
But Psellos straightforwardly says that it has nothing to do with it. So Psellos explains the natural process of transmutation, who, as I already told, he calls metavoli, and he says that he was intending to do a systematic treatment and examine every processing of matter in his treatise, but his patron, Michael Kerularius, to whom he dedicated the work, forced him, let's say, constrained him to deal only with chrysopoeia. So Psellos implies that Kerularius was only interested in chrysopoeia because we well know that from the ancient times, alchemy had a fourfold goal: the making of gold, the making of silver, the making of pearls, gems, and all this kind of valuable material, and of course the making of purple dye, which was the most expensive dye and linked also to the imperial industry. So he says that Kerularius was only interested in chrysopoeia. And after this, he starts to describe some recipes. He lists techniques for making gold, actually for gilding metals, for brightening it, for recipes for doubling the mass of gold, so to augment it, okay, and then a recipe for making a golden dye. And at some point he says that I have given you the whole, let's say, treatment of this art. Years later, in 1058, things had changed dramatically. Psellos composed an indictment of Kerularius on behalf of Emperor Isaac I Komnenos, because Kerularius at this point has lost imperial favor. And Psellos, who once dedicated a letter on alchemy to his patron, now he's, you know, he acquires another role to formally accuse him. So, among the charges that this indictment itemizes are heresy, tyranny, murder, sacrilege, things like that. And among them, Psellos also refers to the patriarch's interest in alchemy. But he does not do this in order to imply that alchemy is something forbidden. He does this because he wants to show that Cerularius was greedy, because he was only interested in making gold. And it is very important that at some point he says that, he implies actually, that the patriarch was an amateur, because he says that he did not know the proportions, neither did he weigh. All he ever managed to accomplish is iron to come again out as iron. So he was, you know, an amateur, let's say a poor assimilator of knowledge. And this is very important, because I think that the implication of alchemy in these charges seems to serve, let's say, a twofold purpose. On the one hand, as I said, to underline the patriarch's obsession for gold and his willingness to resort to every means to acquire it. And on the other hand, he implied that alchemy was an art that provided techniques for gilding, but perhaps for counterfeiting as well.
And one wonders, going back in time to the Emperor Heraclius, if, assuming that your plausible speculation is right, and that Heraclius and maybe his successors, who had a very, very empty treasury in Constantinople, were taking an interest in alchemy to try to fill the treasury, would they have cared so much if it was real gold or just convincing gold, right? As long as it can get past an assayer, as long as it can get back a commercial money changer who is skilled in some pretty effective means of snipping off a tiny bit, assaying it to see if it's real gold, to see the percentage of gold as opposed to alloy. As long as it can get past that guy, they don't care what's going on chemically, right?
I totally agree with you, but I don't think that we're talking about fake gold. But we should see this in terms of debasement, in terms of reducing the amount of gold in an alloy, as you said.
Yeah. When you said doubling the weight, presumably
that means
it still looks like gold, but it's only
of course
half as much gold vis-a-vis some other metals.
And we know well that at some point, actually at certain points, the Byzantine state had deliberately debased the gold coinage, either because of dire situations concerning external politics and all this stuff, but at some time in order to give an impetus to the market.
Right. To increase the
money within the market.
They didn't have economics down to a science, but they did have a few tricks up their sleeves.
Yes.
They
did have them. but you know, the things to continue, if I may, with Cerularius.
Yeah, please do.
The thing is that in the late Roman state, and then again in the Byzantine state, we had a very strict legislation about trickery and counterfeiting of the coinage. So apart from that, we had also legislation about the protection of the customer concerning the guilds of Constantinople. And we have this 10th century Book of the Eparch. This actually means Book of the Prefect. Okay, Eparchos. Yeah. And this book regulated the activity of certain guilds in Constantinople. And one of the guilds that it refers to is the Silversmiths Guild, when they talked about silversmiths, argyroprate, they meant both goldsmiths and silversmiths. So
got it.
This guild processed gold, silver, pearls, and gemstones exclusively. And I just implied that they treated the materials that alchemy was most interested in. Okay. So we have some paragraphs in this book that show that the alteration of precious metal was forbidden. And it resulted to severe punishment, hand amputation. And we have other paragraphs in this book that say that a silversmith must perform his profession only in the workshops of the Messy Street, which was the great commercial street of Constantinople, and not in his home or somewhere else.
Right. So where we can keep an eye on him.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm. And how does the accusation of Psellos against the patriarch ends? He clearly said that just as he was greedy and because he wanted to gild a church, we don't know which church exactly in Constantinople, but this is what Psellos says. He hired some state workers in order to iterate the gold, which was going to be used in order to gild this church in question. So what he says is actually the accusation that the law severely punishes the secret processing and appropriation of gold by state craftsmen. And this is, you know, what connects the mention to alchemy with a proper accusation in Psellos' indictment against the patriarch. It is very, you know, interesting that he makes a full circle, let's say, beginning from alchemy and his and the patriarch's penchant, let's say, interest in it, to come again to the, let's say, alchemical knowledge about counterfeiting, imitating, or, you know, something like this.
Mm, yeah. Gerasimos Merianos, thank you so much for coming and telling us about the state of alchemy in what could be called the Byzantine period, giving us a picture of what's going on. Not a detailed picture in every respect, but definitely a beautiful context with some lovely concrete examples scattered throughout. Even taking us forward to the 11th century, where we're going to see the great Psellos getting involved in so many different aspects of esotericism and politics and religion and everything. So yeah, thanks again for coming on the Shweb.
Thank you. It was an honor.
We'll speak again in the future, I hope. But until then, I invite you to be like the nature of the stone, which is kicked around in the street and seen everywhere, but no one recognizes it for what it is, and stay esoteric.
Thank you.